This season of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is proudly supported by My Music Staff.
Sibelius would write really low in the winds, and you look, go, is that really going to work, you know? And then you listen to the recording and go, wow, it does, you know, in a way that Beethoven didn't do, and that's what's interesting to me.
Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
G'day everyone, and welcome back to Season 2, 2018 of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. You're listening to episode number 125, and a very special welcome to all my Inner Circle Piano Teaching community members. It has been absolutely wonderful to meet so many of you and hear such great things about the podcast at recent events, including MTNA in Florida, and a variety of workshops both here around Australia and overseas too. It's just been phenomenal. I am so glad that it's having such a great impact on you, and I am pleased as well that you seem to be enjoying the seasons too, although I've had a few people say, I really miss hearing you every week, but I've certainly been enjoying putting together some discrete seasons for you this year, and so far, so good. My name is Tim Topham, your host for the show, and if this is your first time here, thank you so much for tuning in. I really hope that you enjoy the content and tell all your piano teaching friends about it. And for those of you who have been tuning in for a while, thanks again for choosing to spend time with me. The Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is your place for inspiration, ideas, business, and teaching strategies to help support your teaching and grow your studio. And the best way to listen to these podcasts is via my piano teaching app. Just search for Tim Topham in your favorite app store. Today's show notes and a full transcript are now available at timtopham.com/episode125. I thought that it would be fun to kick off season two of the podcast with another of my composer spotlights, which feature conversations with some of your most cherished composers and arrangers, delving into their background, teaching, and thoughts on creativity and composition. Last season's discussion in episode 118 with Kevin Olsen was one of the most popular episodes in that season. So today, we're continuing the tradition with another very well-known artist. Before I introduce today's composer, remember that you can access my previous interviews, including the likes of Carol Matz, Dennis Alexander, Pamela Wedgwood, and Irina Gurin, to name just a few, by downloading my app for Apple, Google, or Android devices, or searching at timtopham.com/podcast. My guest today is a prolific arranger, orchestrator, and producer. His work is featured in numerous instrumental recordings, church, choral, and educational piano music. He is also co-author, major composer, and orchestrator of the internationally acclaimed Hal Leonard Student Piano Library. He holds a Bachelor of Music in Composition from California State University and a Master of Music in Composition from the University of Southern California. It is, of course, the fantastic Philip Keverin. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Nice to meet you, Tim.
It's an absolute pleasure to meet you, and I actually can't believe that I'm able to spend some time with you, given all the music that you seem to put out all the time. I'm going to ask you a little bit later on how on earth it's possible for you to create so much music. But before we go into that, can you give all our listeners a bit of a sneak peek into a week in the life of Philip Keverin? What kinds of things do you mainly do?
I have a home studio where I write piano music, but I'm also writing orchestrations for studio work here. And so a lot of my days start with writing around, I'm an early riser, so I'm down here by 6:30 in the morning. And then recording sessions almost always start at 10. So I'll go in and do a 10 to a 1 and sometimes a 2 to a 5, depending on the day. So morning is when I get my piano writing done.
Right. And when you say recording, what are you recording?
Well, I'm an orchestrator. About half my life is spent, I don't know how you would divide it out, but maybe a third of my time is spent doing piano arrangements. And then I work in commercial industry. It might be a documentary, film score, or an artist that's doing a recording here in Nashville, it needs an orchestra, that type of thing.
Right. And do you have a home studio for that?
I don't record an orchestra here, but I do all my pre-production here, you know, MIDI programming and all the things you need to go in and work with the orchestra.
Right. Okay. And then so you'll actually sit at a computer and use Logic or whatever it is to come up with the content, and then you'll output scores, which you'll eventually go and record with a live orchestra. Hopefully.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of the most expensive things.
Well, yeah. And of course, depending on the budget of the project, sometimes, you know, part of the production will use what I've programmed as well, or a mixture thereof, you know.
Yeah. I'm often amazed at just how amazing the quality is now of so many of those samples that you can get in this software. It's almost hard to tell the difference sometimes.
Sometimes it is. It really comes down to the space that surrounds it. You know, it's like the room that you record in could make the difference. I will always prefer a live orchestra any day.
But any composer would say that.
Yeah. But, you know, young producers, a lot of times, they don't care. They're fine with the samples.
Right. Yeah. And now, have you got any notable films or documentaries that our listeners might have seen or heard of that you've worked on in the last few years?
One of the things I'm really was pleased with the way it turned out, there's a show called Saving Augusta that is on Netflix right now.
Right.
That was a great experience. That's something that's floating out there currently.
Okay. And is that a TV multi-part series drama sort of thing?
It's a two-hour documentary about it's a World War II story.
Ah, right.
Very, very interesting story. We could spend this whole thing on that documentary. really interesting story.
If we get time, I'd love to come back to the inspiration for composing and where it all starts. Let's just go on to quick question. Do you do any teaching, or have you taught piano in the past?
I certainly have, and I've kept my hand in that over the years. I'll usually have anywhere from 2 to 3 people that I'm trying to stay current with.
Right.
It's very hard to do both. It has to be somebody. It's usually somebody that's interested in composition, you know, that wants to do that specifically in addition to piano. But yes, I have taught through the years as well.
Right. And I think that comes through in a lot of your arranging, the ways that you can you create your arrangements. Number one, very appealing. Two, very playable as well. And so there's definitely that pianistic element that comes through in all that that you do, well, that I've experienced anyway. And that's probably only a very small part of your complete output. So let's take you back to your piano lessons and your childhood. I want to try and find out, where did this all begin? And was it very much from you, or did you have someone that really drew this composition and arranging out of you?
Yeah, you know, I had very traditional experience in piano. My first teacher, Karen Shervey, was the neighbor in the little town I grew up in. And then I had a wonderful teacher in high school named Fern Davidson here in Idaho in the U.S. Both of these people are very classical, traditional teachers. But I was fortunate in both cases. They let me wander, you know. I was that miserable kid that wanted to turn something upside down, wondered why that accompaniment had to be that way. And, you know, you've had those students, and right. And it can be annoying. And I am grateful that both Karen and Fern would put up with that with me.
Right. And were they able to help you in understanding structure and form and progressions and things like that, or did you find that somewhere else?
Well, they did, but I think they pointed me what I would say in both cases is they pointed me toward great music. And I went traditional. I went to college and got a master's in composition, and I had great teachers all through that process. But I still say the best teacher is always the score. You know, all the secrets are in the music. Listen and watch scores. And I spend a couple hours every week still finding new works that I haven't heard before and getting the score and studying it and listening. And there are a lot of great teachers out there, and a lot of them are dead.
Right. what are you picking up from scores when you're looking at them?
I've been on a Sibelius kick lately, going through the nine terrific symphonies. And as an orchestrator, I'm just seeing what they did to get the sound, you know? Right. What is the combination of that? And then absorbing form, just absorbing how great form happens, you know? But I would say mostly in recent years for me, it's just always an orchestration lesson.
Right.
It's just Sibelius would write really low in the winds, and you look up, is that really going to work, you know? And then you listen to the recording and go, wow, it does, you know, in a way that Beethoven didn't do. And so that's what's interesting to me.
Yeah. And I like encouraging my students to, when they're listening to music, which they all do all the time, to try when they like something, to try and ask themselves why they think they like it. What is it about the music? Is it the orchestration, the progression, the beat, the dance? What's about it to try and build that curiosity in students? It sounds like that's exactly what you've been doing most of your life as well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
And I remember as a kid listening to recording, I'd be next to the radio, I'd start hearing a song I like. I'd have a tape in the cassette recorder. I'd get ready when it came on. I'd press record, and then I'd listen back to it. And you'd always get the
I did that too.
I'm showing my age. You'd always get the DJ talking over the start and the finish, and that really annoyed me.
But it was the beginning of the end for the composers, you know, collecting the royalties, right?
And I'd sit there, and I imagine you probably did the same. You listened over and over and tried to play what you hear, and you learn a massive amount through that.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah. So can you remember what your first ever composition was? Can we take you back?
It's a funny, not funny, but ironic timing of that question, because my parents just sold the home that they raised me in, and they've been in for coming on 60 years. So they lived in the same home, and we had to absolve their estate and all these things. They're both still living, but they have moved into an assisted living thing. And cleaning out the house, my mom found this kid scratching on a piece. It said Sonatina in G major.
Oh, cute.
I have no memory of that whatsoever, but it's my handwriting, and it's just like eight bars of... So I guess my answer is Sonatina in G major.
That's very cute.
It's not publishable, but, you know, it's there.
Did you play through it again?
I did.
Oh, that's great.
Sounds a lot like Clementi to me.
Right.
Like, it might have been completely stolen from Clementi.
There you go. The inspiration's coming through.
Exactly.
You've mentioned Sibelius as someone that you've been looking at recently. Have you got any other big influences on your composing or arranging style?
Oh, boy. Well, specifically for piano music or for music in general?
Let's talk piano music, because most listeners are piano teachers, and that's the music they'll be most familiar with.
I'm a big fan of economy. I love what Kabaleski could do with just a very tight and clean, not necessarily the ultimate sound. I'm not saying necessarily what I would be going for, but the cleanliness and the precision of that writing, I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. I've always had a weak spot for the impressionistic style of music in terms of sound, and I think that bleeds through in some of my arranging. I can't escape. I love that sound.
Yeah. And I've got to then ask you, how on earth, this is the question I've most been wanting to ask you since we booked this, how on earth do you produce so much music? It seems that in the last 5 years, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's just so many more Philip Kevran books all the time coming out of these arrangements. I just can't imagine doing as much as you're doing. You must have a really great workflow or something.
Well, I've been writing a lot of music for coming on 25 years now. It seems like there's been more in the last 5 years, I think, because I've certainly become more efficient in my workflow. I tell folks all the time, I mean, I write every day, minimum of 3 hours every day. If you do everything for a minimum 3 hours every day, you've got to be a bumbling idiot not to come out with something, you know. That's a lot of time. And so I think it's just a matter of consistent. And I don't think a day goes by that I don't write. You know, I do take Saturday off sometimes Sunday off. But it's not that I don't think of myself as a workaholic, but I'm a steady as she goes guy, you know, every day.
And when you say writing, is that composing or arranging, or could it be both?
It's both. I balance it. I mean, I have X number of books that I have to get out every year for Hal Leonard, and that's primarily arranging, although some composing. When I'm working on scores, you know, for in the commercial world, then that's mostly original music. I can't do one or the other. I need variety. That's the way my brain works, you know. I love to compose, but I also love the challenge of taking a piece of music that shouldn't work, you know, that pop piece or that whatever piece that you think, oh, I love that challenge of trying to somehow make it a good piano experience.
Well, I put together some books for the Australian Music Exam Board at the end of last year and included a number. I think we've got about four of your arrangements in there. And I have to say that whenever I play them to teachers, they totally love them. And I'm thinking in particular I don't know if you can remember this, the Goodbye Yellow Brick Road version. It's kind of lower, early advanced. Fix You, Coldplay. And Seasons of Love by Rent, which I use now as a sort of a recital or just a piece I can pull out at any stage. Just so well written and written in different ways too. Like the Goodbye Yellow Brick Road has a lot of challenging runs of demi-semi quavers in batches of 10 in both right hand and left hand, whereas Fix You, again, different approach. Seasons of Love, very different. So I'm interested to know, who decides, one, what you're going to arrange? Do publishers ask you, or do you say, I really want to do Goodbye Yellow Brick Road? And how do you determine how difficult an arrangement you make?
Well, Hal Leonard wants things at basically four different levels, you know, piano solo, easy piano, what they call big note, and then real easy level. And you know, it's a feel for me, a piano. There's a general piano solo level that all of their writers try to achieve, you know, with this sort of intermediate to upper intermediate level. For me, I'm trying to write something that I can sight read fairly well. If I can't sit down and play it successfully in a sight read, then it's too hard for a high school kid to spend, you know, they're going to have to spend too long on it. Mm-hmm. So I just learned over the years kind of where that sits, you know. But sometimes, I mean, I've just finished up a bunch of what we're calling recital suites that they're just now starting to come out that are meant to be advanced level. And that was a stretch for me because I'm really writing something that I would really have to work at to perform myself. And it's taken me longer to do. But did I answer the question? I went with that.
Yes, I mean you are answering it. That question of level. So it's really your publisher will actually say, well, these are the four levels, and we need a book of show tunes that's big note, and you go and do that or exactly. That sort of thing. Yeah.
And it has evolved over the years too, from the standpoint that I don't think my easy piano is necessarily the same as maybe what their general easy piano is, maybe. But my audience kind of knows what to expect from me in that what has evolved, and I feel comfortable with it. But for me, it's always about, you know, you mentioned earlier, it's just, even if it's advanced, it needs to fit under the hands in a way that makes it learnable in a reasonable amount of time. You know, I just do not want to spend 6 months learning Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. You know what I mean? That's stretching the limit, actually, that particular arrangement, if I remember properly. That's on the higher end of what I would write for that level.
Yes, yeah. We've put it in grade 7, and it took me some practice, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you find some genres harder to arrange than others?
Yes.
And what are the hard and easy ones?
Well, when I was younger, I would get asked a lot, oh, you got to do a current pop collection from this year. You know, we need that from you. I finally just say, I don't want to do. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do hits from 2018 because I don't want to have to find 15 songs that are worthy of putting into a collection. There aren't enough, frankly. And I finally, after just banging my head against the wall, maybe 5 or 6, 7 years ago, I just said, I don't want to do contemporary pop. A little more time goes by and we know what the best songs were from that time period. I'll do a collection, but.
And the reason is that because of your feeling about just lack of depth in the music that's coming out today?
Well, yeah, and I don't want to sound like an old poop about that. You know, there's good stuff coming out always, you know, but not enough for a full collection in
right.
a year.
Yeah.
You know, you need 3 or 4 years to get enough stuff that has melodic material that you can make it work on the piano. Because there are some very cool recordings that I love as productions, but I don't want to try to make a piano solo out of it, you know.
They're the hard ones when kids want to play them as well, and they sound fantastic on the recording, and I love them. And you go, oh, look, I'm going to try and help you a little bit, but maybe this one's a better one.
exactly. It's just they were never designed to be.
That's right.
A piano experience.
And I was very conscious when choosing popular music for this series that I just mentioned before that the pop had to have stood the test of time before I put it in, because there's just no point putting a 2018 hit in there probably because it just won't be in fashion in a couple of years. And so you have this very distinct end life to these things you've worked so hard to put together. So I totally agree.
Yeah.
What about the easier ones? I wondered whether classical might be quite an easy thing to arrange, or maybe that's a tricky one.
Well, you know, opera themes and classical themes, that's somewhat easier because obviously it's great music. I don't particularly like taking piano things and simplifying them. I very, very rarely do that. I just think let the piano things lay where they were originally written. But I love taking, you know, orchestral themes and out of the symphonic literature. And my favorite, really, still to this day, I love doing folk tunes. I love doing these great little melodies that just give you the chance to do something almost a composition more than an arrangement, because it's not, you know, there's not that much there in terms of length, but there's a great, great melody, you know?
Yep. Now, a quick word from our sponsor, My Music Staff. My Music Staff is the most popular studio management software available to music teachers around the world. I've even written a blog post on how I personally used My Music Staff to transition to automatic monthly payments. All of my students now receive an automatic invoice each month and their credit cards are charged instantly. My Music Staff has become an essential part of my own studio, and I've effectively been able to put my entire teaching business on autopilot. One of the great things about My Music Staff is that it scales with your studio. When you start growing your business, it doesn't mean more work for you. From student management to scheduling and billing, it offers you everything you need to manage your business with ease. There's even a student portal that allows students to notify you of any upcoming absences and even reschedule missed lessons without needing your input. It's a great solution for any teacher looking to improve their business and set themselves apart from their competition. Head to mymusicstaff.com to start your 30-day free trial today. I always ask composers and arrangers that I interview, and you're one of a few that I've done recently, if you have a favorite composition or arrangement that you could pull out of your how many of you do you think you've written or arranged in your 25-year career?
Well,
what would you guess?
It's into the 400 or 500 folios, I would guess. Song titles, it has to be into the thousands.
Yeah.
I don't know. Currently in print in my series, I think there's 125 or something books, something like that.
Wow. Okay.
I think my favorite book in recent years has been a book called Classical Folk. And it basically were character pieces built around great folk songs. That one came together in a way that still pleases me.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, that's not one I'm familiar with, so we'll have to pop a link in the show notes to for people to be able to find that one. Is that a Hal Leonard publication?
It is.
Uh-huh. Great. Can you tell us how the Hal Leonard arrangement came about? What was it, a composition or arrangement in particular that allowed you to be picked up by a publisher?
My first job out of college was I was a staff composer at Yamaha. Yamaha Education Systems in the U.S. had an office in L.A., and that's where I went to college. And that's where I got a crash course in pedagogy, because I knew nothing about writing for pedagogical use. But I was on staff there, and I learned from some great writers. And during that time, I did a pop arrangement of something that was in a Yamaha publication that somebody at Hal Leonard saw. And then I started doing non-credited arrangements of standards and things that for easy piano level. And then around 1988 or 89, somewhere around there, I did my first credited arrangements. I think the first book that maybe has my name in it, when you asked me that, I think it might be, of all things, I think it was a score. It was Dances with Wolves, film score.
Oh, yeah. I remember the film.
Yeah. And, you know, the music, I think that may be the first time I did something.
Right. Something that a publisher had asked you to do. A commission kind of thing.
Right. And that would have been around 1990, I guess, something like that.
Right. And so are there times these days that you go to Hal and say, hey, I've just put together this box of five, this book of five great things. I really think you should publish it. Or does it really always happen in the other direction?
It goes both ways. We're in a constant state of communication. They just sent me a note and said, what do you think about doing The Who for classical piano?
Okay.
I said, that would be fun, you know? So I'm busy right now trying to put a song list together for that. I wanted to do the Disney recital suites and Beatles. I'm doing collections of each Beatles album. So in putting them together in suites, that was an idea I pitched. Sometimes it takes forever because the Beatles people, the Apple Corp in London, they take forever. You know, you put it in and 6 or 8 months later, you finally get it. Okay. And Disney's slow too.
Mm.
And other times they might have an exclusive on it and it's easy, you know. It's kind of both ways. We just, we've had a long, long relationship and it's kind of a shorthand at this point between. Right.
And I would imagine that the copyright is all handled by Hal, but do they tend to wait for the approval before you start even working, or do you work in the hope that you'll get approvals?
Most of the time, it is already basically in the, they have an arrangement with that copyright holder. But there are some, for instance, Andrew Lloyd Webber, when you do a collection for a really useful music group, you have approval to arrange it, but that doesn't mean it's going to be published. It goes into their offices and somebody in there plays through them and sends you back your tweak list, you know.
Oh, really?
The B-flat needs to be an A-flat. Yeah, he's very finicky about if you go too far with a harmony that's outside of what he or whoever it is that's in his office. I really don't know who's
calling. I'm sure it's not him. Yeah.
It's not him. I think he's been too writing his autobiography. But yeah. But in the case of John Williams goes through every single score that is released with his name on it. And he's very particular, and you get your proofs back with little notes from him. He's a composer's composer. He cares about his work. Mm. And yet they're all very logical. His comments, I get it. I want to do that. You know, sometimes the ones that are going into other places where you've got somebody that may or may not know that much about music, they've just got a checklist of things that they're looking for, and who knows
what. Right.
But that's rare. Most of the time, stuff just, if they have a print right to it, it gets printed.
Okay. And you've just reminded me of a book I'm pretty sure you wrote. I'm picturing it's kind of red and blue, and it's about Bach. You've rearranged the classics in the style of someone else.
Those are jazz arrangements. Yeah.
Yes. I've just suddenly realized another book of yours that I've enjoyed exploring. So there you go. You've had a big impact.
I loved that. That was fun doing. Although my wife says that if I'm so fortunate to walk through the pearly gates, that the first thing I'm going to do is get clocked by Bach, you know, for messing around with his classics.
You know, I would think the opposite. He would be shaking your hand and congratulating you because that's exactly what he loved doing, though, wasn't it?
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he'd support you in that. So can you give us just a quick glimpse, and this is going to lead on to my next question about teaching arranging and some ideas around that. Can you give us a glimpse into how you actually go about arranging something? I'm wondering, once you've got the level you need to write for, is it about the pattern or the feel? Like, is it going to be a habanero or is it going to be a jazz or is it something else? What's the little process?
When it's a folio, when you got 15 or 20 songs, there's a little bit of having to get a picture of the whole, you know, and all right, I can't, you know, if I'm going to do something in a Chopin-esque style for this, you know, I'll save that for this song, you know, this song might fit into this sort of thing. So there's a little bit of that kind of juggling going on to make sure the book fits together. And sometimes it's just luck. I mean, honestly, it's sitting down at the piano and fiddling around. To me, I don't mean to oversimplify it, but I really do, to a lot of degrees, I go back to my head of when I was a kid wanting to play the piano and the things that were fun to do. You remember the things that really got you excited and try to say, what is it about this? What can I do with this song that would draw somebody into wanting to play it, you know? And as you know, as a pianist, sometimes it's a sound, but it's also sometimes the feel.
Mm, definitely.
The things that feel right under the hands that are fun to do. So it's a combination of all those things.
Right. Yeah. So it takes a bit of a big picture look at things, where everything fits in, and then you start playing the originals and sometimes things just emerge.
Well, and I also I'm a crazy, you probably are too, I buy books way too much.
No, we all do that. Yep. Good to hear that even someone that creates them does that too.
Oh, I do. When I travel promoting my books, my wife calls it deficit travel. I come back with more than I probably sold. You know, I just love piano music and I love all types, but. And I'll just pull something off and play, you know, and try to get inspired by somebody else's stuff, you know.
Mm. So have you got any tips now for teachers in encouraging their own students to arrange music or even compose, I guess?
I know that this subject gets bandied about a lot in the teaching world. And I think the thing that you have to do, at least in my mind, is be willing to stretch yourself beyond what you're comfortable with. I think sometimes we want to teach what we know, but a student that really wants to learn about thus and such, be willing to learn along with them. You know, you may never have played this particular kind of music or know anything about it, but let's explore it together. You know, since composition and arranging is where I'm most comfortable, that's where, you know, that part is easier for me. But what might be harder is, you know, a student that wants to play, you know, Liszt, that my technique, I'm like, I don't have the hands to play this, but you do. And let me help you find a way to do it. I think arranging and composing comes out of playing lots of great literature. So don't just teach the pieces you know, you know. Find new things and let them bring things to you too and play a lot of different styles. My biggest grumble about piano teaching is when we reduce things down to here's the list of stuff that, you know, that we will teach and we'll learn on the piano. When there's all this great stuff floating around from currently and then, you know, 100 and 200 years ago, be adventurous.
That's great. And kids want to have that autonomy or, you know, a say in what goes on in their lessons now. You can't just direct them so much and just tell them what to do. They want to have some say, and I think that's only reasonable. And as you say, that brings in new material. Even if it's not amazing, you're out of your comfort zone a little bit. You're trying new things.
Yeah, and I think the only thing you do have to do is when they bring in they want to play something from Frozen and they bring in the piano vocal edition of it that's unplayable, right? You do have to at times say, this is going to maybe make you quit playing the piano. let's find a version that's at a level that you can be successful at. So sometimes you have to tweak that a bit, but.
And I'm more and more to teach students when it comes to pop music, teach students how to play the chords and encourage them to sing, because ultimately that's what the music was designed for. And yeah. So, you know, trying to play the vocal line in your pinky and fourth finger while you're playing chords, I mean, it's so difficult.
Yeah, that's great.
And what about for kids that bring in compositions of their own? I have a lot of teachers say, oh, this kid's just brought in this thing and it's kind of clunky, or maybe it's amazing. But yeah. What do I do to encourage them?
Well, what I would say is sometimes, and this may sound strange coming from someone, you know, I have to write all this stuff down. Sometimes I think we get a little too hung up on making sure every I is dotted and T is crossed. Is their notation perfect at this point, and get all wrapped up in that presentation. And I'm a little less concerned about that. You know, that will come, but what are the ideas and how, you know, could this section is really good. Could you extend that? And I think sometimes they get really, really rooted down and lost and overwhelmed when they feel like they have to be able to notate it perfectly too early in the process. Mm. That's one thing I would caution.
Right. Yeah. And I wholeheartedly agree. And it also takes a lot of time as a teacher to help a student to learn to notate or to correct notation and to help them with that. So I'd much prefer to be getting them composing more and creating more than focusing on that nitty gritty, at least at the start.
I agree. Mm. And the only thing I do is it when they get older, I just had a student a couple of years ago that almost coming to college level where had never actually written a note on a piece of paper, could make finale do anything.
Right.
And I'm really glad that you know how to work finale, but you need to learn how to get out a pad and write it so that you know why the slur line is where it is, you know, and not you're not dependent on the program making all these decisions
for right. you. That's a good question for you then. Do you tend to write your music as you arrange, or do you go straight to digital now?
I go straight to digital.
Yeah.
I wrote in pencil for years and years and years and years and years, and I fought against it. But, you know, once you're into that, once you start writing in a program, you can never go back. It's so much more efficient. Hal Leonard takes – I send in my stuff done in Finale, but they actually redo it all in Sibelius anyway. Because they have their own
typesetting specifications.
Yeah.
And stuff.
Yeah. If any of them are watching this now, they're going, they're probably screaming. They've been after me for years to switch to Sibelius because that's what they use. And, you know, I've been using Finale since 1989, you know, or no, well, I early 90s, whatever. Too long. I'm not going to switch at this point.
Fair enough. Well, look, we'll start wrapping things up. I've just got a couple more questions for you. One is about teachers or university level students who would like to publish their own arrangements or be found by a publisher. I imagine that's getting really difficult these days. It's probably like the rest of the music industry. Labels don't hand out contracts quite so much anymore, I don't imagine. Have you got any tips for teachers or students that want to publish their own arrangements or compositions?
Well, if I were starting out now, I would have a web page and I would be writing original stuff and putting it up there and making it available to people just with my own self-publishing, honestly. And I think that can lead to then if an arrangement with a publisher that acquires print rights. It's a waste of time. Well, I shouldn't say that. I think it is a waste of time chasing after print rights and saying, I want to do Beauty and the Beast. You know, well, good luck with that. It's just, you know, the corporate publishing thing makes that almost impossible, you know? Mm. So write great stuff and then see where that leads you. And I think it's exciting to be able to self-publish like that. And I probably will do that at some point in the future when I'm not wanting to write as much and semi-retirement, and just write original stuff and put it on my site.
Right.
That's where I would start.
And we're lucky today that we have the ability to have websites, build them easily, freely, just about, and post things on YouTube as well. So I think that's a great bit of advice.
Yeah.
All right, last question for you, Philip. What's the one big thing you'd like teachers to take away from today's interview?
I think I would go back to what we said a little bit earlier, and that is to allow yourself to be pulled out of your comfort zone. Don't always teach the same method that you've always taught. Be open to doing a variety of different things. Don't always take every student in the same direction where you know where the path leads. You know, we get locked into these patterns, but be open to, I'm not saying that the student is taking over your teaching, but follow that path, you know, that gets open for you through that student. I think the only thing that keeps life interesting is to keep learning. And I would encourage whatever your love is. My love is orchestral music, so I listen to orchestral scores and study them. Your love is piano literature. Don't quit studying piano literature. Listen and listen, and you pick up a book, a new collection of whatever, and find five different people playing it and see what the differences are between. I think we don't spend enough time continuing our learning, and that's what makes it fun. Keep it fresh for yourself.
Well, that's a fantastic note to finish on. Thank you so much, Philip. Where should people go to find out more about you and find your resources?
Well, everything piano-wise for me at this point is at Hal Leonard.
Okay.
My own website currently is dark. I'm rebuilding it right now, which is.
You mean dark fun. As it's not around or it looks black?
Right. If you go to philipkevren.com right now, you'll see nothing.
Okay, right.
But in about 6 months, it will reappear, and I'm going to try some experiments on there.
Fantastic. I'm
looking forward to doing.
philipkevren.com for people in a few months, depending on when you listen to this, of course. So that's going to be about midway or towards the end of 2018. Thank you so much for your time today, Philip. Really appreciate it. And I know a lot of people have got lots out of what you've said.
I appreciate it. Nice to meet you, Tim.
Thanks so much. Well, I really hope you enjoyed that discussion as much as I did with Philip Kevren. What a superstar of the arranging and composing world. Just fantastic to hear all that he has been producing and creating, and will continue to do so in the future. And great to hear some of his tips and strategies around the teaching side of things too. So a few reminders before I sign off. Firstly, we released last week my preschool version of Notebook Beginners. It was a really popular webinar. And for those of you who joined us, thank you very much for tuning in. And for those of you who missed it, then we have got a full course which breaks down Notebook Beginners, which is my approach to teaching beginner students without any method books or reading for the first up to 10 weeks. We've got a full course that breaks that down for ages 5 and under. Regardless of whether you're doing group or individual lessons, this all works for you as a part of my Inner Circle piano teaching community. It's in our course academy, along with all of our other courses that are available there for our members. So if that is of interest to you, then the best way to access it is to head to timtopham.com/community if you're not already a member. And I'm also currently putting the finishing touches on my much-anticipated GarageBand course. When we can easily spend $50 a month or more on paid apps for our studio, sometimes significantly more, this one is absolutely free. It's available on any Apple device and is incredibly clever and handy to have in your studio. But I know that a new technology like this can be a little bit overwhelming if you haven't tried it out before. So I'm actually laying out a 10-lesson video course, looking over my shoulder as I use this in the way that I teach with it. And it links in so, so well with my ideas around, for example, four-chord composing. So more on that later this month when I go live with a free webinar. And of course, we'll be releasing that whole course as soon as it's available to our Inner Circle community. Remember also that if you have a spare 5 minutes and would be interested in leaving me a review, either on iTunes or Facebook, regarding any of the resources that I put out or the podcast, then I would really, really appreciate it. It does have an impact on how I rank in the stores, the iTunes stores and on Facebook and things like that. So if you are getting value from this and you haven't done that already, please take a moment to do it. It really means a lot. You can find out exactly how and get all the links at timtopham.com/review. Next week on the podcast, we're going to be taking care of business. If you've ever wondered which aspects of your studio business can have the biggest effect on your bottom line, we're going to dive into actual data and find out. Does having a clean professional invoice have an impact on the amount that you can charge? Does allowing parents to pay by check have a positive or negative impact? And if you find absences and makeups a nightmare, then definitely stay tuned, because we found a way to allow you to totally take your hands off this aspect of scheduling. And what about providing a sign-up form directly online so that you can avoid any kind of manual paperwork for your new students? Well, if all of that sounds interesting, find out the solutions by tuning in at the same time and the same place next week. I'm Tim Topham, and this is the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.
We'll conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon Piano Podcast for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.